Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we should stop.
Okay. So I'm gonna.
Okay. If you want,
okay.
Okay.
I really want to thank Rabbi Alex for coming to our community to speak to us, to share words of Torah. It's really an honor to have Rabbi Alex here. Most of you probably know, but Rabbi Alex Israel is an educator par excellence who has certainly deepened my love and appreciation for Tanakh. He has taught at a number of prestigious institutions in Israel and currently teaches at Yeshivat Eretz HaTzvi and is the director of community education at Pardes, as well as he is involved in a number of extraordinary institutions such as Sohar and the Beit Hillel Rabbinic Organization. So, and I also wanted to mention that you can continue to learn from Rav Alex even after this year from his website and from a recently published book on Melachim. So thank you so much.
Okay. Great. If anybody wants to, I brought copies of the book, if anybody wants to purchase the copy, so afterwards I'll be happy to. So, Erev Tov, thank you for inviting me to come speak here, and very delighted to be here for the first time. Today, even though I generally talk about Tanakh, I'm actually not going to be focusing so much on the Tanakh personality of Ezra, which there is a lot to be spoken about. Rather I'd like to try and talk about the more rabbinic personality of Ezra and maybe discover a side of Ezra and let's expand that to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which maybe we're not so aware of. If you ask most people, you know, what did Ezra do? Who is he? So they'll tell you Ezra built the second Beit HaMikdash. So first of all, I hate to say it, but that's a load of nonsense. And the reason why that's a load of nonsense is because we know exactly when the second Beit HaMikdash was built. It was built in according to Ezra, Perek Vav, the second Beit HaMikdash was built in the sixth year of Darius. And Darius was king way before the time of Artaxasta. Ezra only came to Israel from Persia in the seventh year of Artaxasta, which is approximately something like 60 years later. In other words, when Ezra came to Jerusalem, the temple was already standing. It was in shambles. It wasn't functioning well. And Ezra certainly renovated the Second Temple period, but Ezra did not build the Second Temple. I even put a little timeline, if you've got the sheets here, just to give everybody a little bit of perspective to understand when Ezra lived. So I put here, you know, if you go from left to right, in 586 BC, the First Temple is destroyed. We go to Babylon. 536, the Cyrus Declaration. Cyrus, the first Persian king, king of the Persian Empire, and Jews are allowed to return to Jerusalem. 515, Second Temple is rebuilt. And around 450, much later, is when Ezra comes on the scene, and that's what we're dealing with. Just to give you some understanding, the story of Hanukkah is in 164. We'll talk about that. And as you can see, Second Temple's destroyed in 70 CE. So we want to try and talk a little bit about Ezra and his legacy. How you doing? And the legacy that he has left us. And in particular, I'd like to talk about the group which we call the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly. Why are the two associated, or... you know, how are the two associated? Frequently, we will see Ezra associated with this group, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly. Chazal tell us the men of the Great Assembly were 120 people. We don't quite know what they did. By the way, today's Knesset has 120 Chavrei Knesset, 220 members of parliament, because of the Knesset HaGdolah, right? It's just the Knesset, not the Knesset HaGdolah, and they behave accordingly sometimes. You know, 120 Chavrei Knesset, and they still had that, but we don't really know what the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah did. We don't know whether they were merely some sort of Sanhedrin, dealing with random cases? Were they a legislative body who wanted to sort of, you know, have a sort of activist legislative, you know, role? Were they an administrative body? But we know the Anshei Knesset Gdolah start around the time of Ezra, the beginning of the Second Temple period, and we in Pirkei Avot, so it'll be a good place to start, we hear talk about people who are Mishiarei Knesset Gdolah, people who are left afterwards, and we know about when they lived. So let's maybe start off with our first source to put them in a perspective. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, umasara li Yoshua, Yoshua lizkenim, uzkenim linviim, unviim asaru ala Anshei Knesset Gdolah. We have a chain of tradition here. By the way, this chain of tradition is not so coherent from a historical perspective, but I think we can understand it from a textual or a book perspective. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, right? Just again, the interesting phrase. You think, Kibel et Torah me HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? It's a sort of strange phrase, but okay. He gave it to Yoshua. That's the book of Yoshua, right? He gave it to the Zekenim. Sefer Shoftim begins talking about the Zekenim Asher Ha'erichu Yamim Acharei Yehoshua. So there we already have the Zekenim. That's the period of Shoftim. Zekenim gave it to the Nevi'im. Where do we find the Nevi'im? In two books, right? In Shmuel and in Malachim. Okay? So that's what we call the prophet period. And they passed it on to the Anshei Knesset Gdolah. This is now talking about the Second Temple period. So, we know this is a group of people. Traditionally, Ezra is associated with them. Second Temple period. How long do they continue? We hear about Shimon HaTzadik in the next Mishnah. Hayam Mishiarei Knesset Gdolah. So already Shimon HaTzadik, okay, is sort of one of the last people of the Anshei Knesset Gdolah. There are stories about Shimon HaTzadik possibly meeting Alexander the Great. It's not entirely clear. There's a lot of myth about that. And if you read the academic writings, they'll question whether he possibly could have. I don't know if you know the Midrash, but it talks about him going out with the Big Day Kahuna and dazzling somehow Alexander the Great. I'm not going to get into that whole story, but let's simply say that if you read any sort of academic history of rabbinics, they will tell you that more or less from the time of the return to Zion, and certainly from the time of Ezra, till about the time of Hanukkah, and that's why I put the date of Hanukkah, or a little bit before, we're dealing with a period of about 300 years. We have the Anshei Knesset Gdolah, and it's remarkable that we know very little about them. We certainly have no external sources, non-Jewish sources, historical sources, and we only have internal sources to talk about. It's almost like it's a funny black hole in our history. We don't quite understand what happened during that period. We've got evidence afterwards. We don't have a lot of evidence during. And because of that, if we really want to build up and understand what this group did, we have to just deal with what the Gemara tells us about them. And when we read what the Gemara tells us about them in the various Braitot, we'll see that this group were quite an incredible group. So I'm going to try and build it up stage by stage, and then we'll put it in a philosophical context. All right, so let's begin still in that first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. It says, Heim amru shlosha dvarim. They said three things. Hevu matunim badin. Number one, be moderate in judgment or in justice. Number two, he'emidu talmidim harbe. Establish many students. And asyu siag la Torah. Make a fence around the Torah. Okay, now I'm sure you've all learned this mission, but I'd like to put it in a sort of historical context. In fact, I want to get out my tonight. When Ezra comes back, he finds a sort of a very, very desperate situation. You might well warm tonight. Okay. We read the story in Sefer Ezra. In fact, I'm reading from the end of Nehemiah. And he describes the situation. It's not on your sheet, I'm sorry. He describes the situation. He says, "Bayamim ahema ra'iti biyuda dorchim kitot b'shabbat. I found people who were treading grapes on Shabbat. Umaviyim aremot v'omsim al chamorim. They were taking things from the field and putting them on donkeys. People were bringing things from the fields on Shabbat. And he says, Va'id b'yom michram tzayid, va'atzorim yashvu ba mevim dag v'chol mecha u'morchim b'shabbat. And there are people called Tzorim, maybe people from Tsar, from the coast, who are bringing fish to Jerusalem on Shabbat. And what he talks about is, he says, what he did was he, Vahi kashet salalu sharei Yerushalayim lifnei Shabbat, when the sun went down on Erev Shabbat, when the shadow, salalu, when the shadows came down, V'omar v'yisagru adatot, I said, close the gates of Jerusalem. Asher lo yiftichu adachar Shabbat. Nobody should open them till after Shabbat. U'mina'arai ha'maditi al asharim, I put men, watchmen, on the gates. Lo yabo masa b'yom Shabbat. Nobody should bring things in or out of Jerusalem on Shabbat. And it says, V'yalinu harochim u'mochrei kol miruchah michutz Yerushalayim pa'am u'shnayim. One Shabbat, two Shabbatot. All of the tradesmen stayed outside the walls. And he says, and I went and warned them. And I said, "Va'ida b'hem v'omra, madua atem lanim neged achoman tishnu yadi eshlach b'chem." You should know, by the way, that Ezra was sent to Jerusalem with a writ from the king of Persia that he could pronounce even the death sentence, the death penalty, death sentence. He was allowed to enact law on behalf of the Persian government, and he says, "You better be very careful. If you come here a third Shabbos, I'll deal with you." They didn't come anymore. When Ezra comes to Yerushalayim, he finds a situation where there is no Shabbat observance, where there is widespread intermarriage, where the temple is in disrepair, and he sets his mind to changing that situation. How is he going to do it? Very simply. First of all, if somebody says to you, the word in Hebrew for matunim, matun, means be moderate, okay? Matun is somebody in political sense in Israel is a moderate, if they're called matun. Okay? If you say something to somebody, be moderate, what are they thinking of doing? They're thinking of being radical, right? Extreme. Okay? The first thing we hear about is be moderate in judgment. That means that we have here an activist court. Activist court. What are they going to do? Number one, He'emidu talmidim harbeh. He is going to spread the Torah. By the way, that's also written by the king of Persia, that he is allowed to spread the Torah of Hashem. And he goes there to teach. And we'll see how he's going to do that. The second thing he is going to do is make a fence around the Torah. Not just a fence around Jerusalem, a fence around the Torah. What's an example of a siag Torah, a fence around the Torah, that we know? So Muktzah is the classic one, right? And in fact, Chazal say, not surprising on the basis of some of these stories in Nehemiah, Muktzah was established by Nehemiah in the same time, along with Ezra. In other words, what we're seeing here is they're going to, if the core principles, intermarriage, so they make laws to do with marriage, if Shabbat's not being observed, we'll make extra laws on Shabbat, okay, etc., etc., we're going to expand Judaism. What I'm claiming is, this is not an incidental agenda. This is a deliberate agenda. The Anshei Knesset Golah say, Hevim Mutinim Badin, we're going to do a lot of changes, but let's keep it down, okay, but we're going to make a lot of changes, and we're going to really try and expand the world of Jewish education. That's what this group is. Now let's see it in action. Okay. Source number two. Gemara in Brachot says, again, I've taken real snippets, but I think you'll see they're going to all build up to a very comprehensive picture. Source number two. Amalei Rabbi Shimon Bar Abba, the Rabbi Yochanan, Mechde. The men of the great assembly established for Israel brachot and tefillot, blessings and prayers, k'dushot v'havdalot. Now, this might seem like a small thing, but I want to understand what a huge thing it is. Let's start off with the first two, brachot and tefillot. And one brachot, it's amazing to think at the time that there were no brachot. The formula, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, they're the ones who established it. Think about how many actions when we eat and make a bracha rishona, according to the Torah, v'achalta v'savata v'erachta. Okay? Anybody who's learned the Gemara in Brachot, they talk about, okay, it's deoraita to say a bracha achrona, but what about a bracha rishona? Anshei Knesset Golah. Every time we put something in our mouth, we make a bracha. Birchot ha-mitzvah. You're probably aware of the idea of in the world of Chassidut, they say, you know, L'shem Yichud Kudsha Brichu, Hinni Mukhan Musulman. There's a famous Noda Bihuda who says, why do you need to say that? Why do you think you've got a bracha? That's what a bracha is meant to do. It's meant to focus your mind on God before you do a religious act. We know that mitzvot srichot kavana, but ein srichot kavana is the question, but we use a bracha in order to be able to put our minds to know that we're doing a religious act. So brachot are amazing, you know, piece of our religious world. But let's take tefillot. Again, too many sources, but I'll say this without the source in front of me. I'm sure many of you have learned the Rambam, Hilchot Tefillah, where the Rambam says that in the first temple period, there are no organized prayers. What prayers were there? Maybe Sefer Tehillim. Maybe bits of Sefer Tehillim. When people came together, possibly, they said bits of Sefer Tehillim. There are a couple of other scraps which we find, which is now in our prayer book, like Hodu Lashem Kiru Bishmo, which appear in Divrei HaYamim and possibly was said in the first temple. But take our most basic prayer, the Shemona Esrei, didn't exist in the first temple period. Come the second temple, this group, they say, you know, we've got to have a prayer that we're going to say three times a day. The Rambam says, in the first temple, you'd get up in the morning and you'd get, you know, maybe it was easier that way, right? You'd have to get up in the morning, you'd say, ah, I'm alive, thank you God, that's great, you know, can you do this, you know, give me a good day. Give me a raise today. That was it. You daven shacharis, right? It was all over. There was no text, right? Somebody, you know, Chas V'Shalom had, you know, financial difficulties, health difficulties, they'd go and appeal to that, but there was no text. The men of the Great Assembly start creating the framework of the 18 brachot. It seems to have started slowly. Maybe they started off with the ends of the brachot. Baruch Atah Hashem, Chanun Hamar Ben Islach, Baruch Atah Hashem, Rofei Cholei Amo Yisrael, etc. And then they were made longer and longer. But they create the framework. By the way, it's a framework which continued being honed and developed because we know that they're still talking about it in the Beit Din of Rabban Gamliel, the question of whether they add a 19th bracha. And we know from the Gniza, from the Cairo Gniza, that there were all sorts of alternative texts. At the beginning, they just set up the beginning and the end, and you could vary the middle. And then it became sort of more encrusted. But again, think about it. The men of the Great Assembly establish prayer, prayer order. What does that mean? First of all, I think it was Rabbi Soloveitchik who said that our prayers are not a list of things that we want. They're a list of things which we should want. Right? They're a list of priorities of Am Yisrael. It's like sort of a menu of the things that a Jew needs. Okay? By the way, I read that in Rabbi Soloveitchik, but I've also found the same idea in the writings of Franz Rosenzweig. So this matches a lot of different worlds. And what they were essentially saying was, they're giving us an order of things that we need. But think about it. Once we have an order of prayer, once we have a fixed text, we can pray together. Once we can pray together, we don't need to just go to the Bet Midrash to pray together. We have the new invention of an institution, which we nowadays call the Bet Knesset. Suddenly, in Beit Sheni, we start finding a Bet Knesset. We have a Bet Knesset in Kfar Nachum. We have a Bet Knesset in Beit Alpha. We have a Bet Knesset in Gamla, which dates to Second Temple period. Some of you have probably visited the Bet Knesset in Herodion or in Masada. You won't find any Batei Knesset from the First Temple. And it's not because they've been destroyed. It's because they didn't exist. Because once you have a fixed text, we can pray together. We can have a Shliach Tzibor and we can follow. So, they've established Brachot. Tefillot. This is amazing. They've created a whole liturgy. Suddenly the liturgy, which is really in many ways a sort of like soundtrack for our religious lives, is now being developed by these people. From what? Out of nothing. Maybe I shouldn't say out of nothing. A lot of our prayers, if you go through the prayer book, you will see that a lot of the phrases come straight out of Tanakh. Ha'el, ha'gadol, ha'gibor, ha'manorah comes straight out of Sefer Devarim. Ha'shiva shoftenu k'varishona comes out of Vishayahu Perek Bet, I think it is. Etc., etc. Many phrases will come and lifted straight out of Tanakh. They used already existing language, but they created a new liturgy. Let's talk about Kiddush and Havdalah. I said, people weren't paying attention to Shabbos. So what did they do? They said, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to create, you know, like the Olympics, right? The Olympics on at the moment. Okay, we're going to create the opening ceremony, Kiddush, and the closing ceremony, right? And Havdalah, so you'll know when Shabbos comes in, right? You lift up a glass and you say Kiddush. Shabbat ends, you light a candle and you say Havdalah. That's great. So now we've got a sort of a ceremony to Kabbalat Shabbat. We've got a Malava Malka, we've got a Yitziat Shabbat, and now we've sort of got, you know, ending and beginning, we're sort of like being able to sort of frame Shabbat. So I want you to realize in these four phrases in this Gemara and Brachot, Judaism has just changed dramatically. Suddenly we've got prayers and therefore we've got a shul. Okay? Suddenly we've got Brachot to say at all sorts of opportunities in our daily lives, and we've got the beginnings of a prayer book. Okay? As I say, by the way, Bayit Rishon, probably there was some sort of prayer book in the form of Sefer Tehillim. Okay? But this is much more developed. It's much more robust. That was source number two. Okay? We're already seeing they've done a lot of things. Let's talk about source number three. Mara Yeshua, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. I think I should say Omar. Actually, I think my cutting and pasting went wrong here. Okay, not Mar, but Omar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Esrim bi arba taniyot yashvu anshei kneset agdola al kotvei svarim tfilin umezuzot shelo yitashru shilmalei mitashrim eim kotvim. I don't know if anybody here is a sofer. You might not like this Gemara. Okay, but basically the men of the Great Assembly fasted 24 fasts. It's a little weird, right? So that anybody who's in the business of writing Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzot, should not get wealthy. If they get wealthy, they're going to stop writing. Apparently it's very arduous to write. I live in Alon Shvut. I have a sofer who lives in my yeshuv. I always wondered what he did all day, because if I ever went to the latest minyan, he was always there, right? And then if I went to the 1 o'clock minyan for mincha, he was always there. And, you know, I once asked him, I said to him, you know, how come you're always at the latest minyan, you're always at the lunchtime minyan? He said, what do you want me to do? He says, if I try and write for more than 3 hours at a time, it kills my back, it kills my eyes. So I sit and learn a little bit, I go to the mikveh, I go to shachrit to the latest minyan, I write for 3 hours, I need a break, I go to mincha, I go to sleep, and then I can write again for 3 hours. I can't write more than 6 hours a day. I mean, I will say this guy is 60 years old, but it's hard work, right? If you can go into, I don't know, you know, some more lucrative profession, right? If he could be a stockbroker, then, you know, he wouldn't be writing tefillin and mezuzos. They said, we're going to 24 fast, people should keep on writing. Why? Because writing is not like nowadays. This is the publishing business. If we don't have people writing, there are no books. And we said, one of the agendas here is, Ha'emiru Talmidim Harbeh. We need a lot of texts. And therefore we need to make Sifrei Torah, and we need those people to write. So they put a lot of energy. I mean, the energy they put in, according to this Gemara, is fasting. I don't know. Maybe they put in other energies. I always thought instead of fasting, they should just, like, I don't know, create some subsidies or something. Create some incentives. But, okay, I don't know. They didn't ask me for financial models of how to increase the publishing of Sifrei Torah. Whichever way, part of their whole agenda here is to create more Jewish texts, Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzot. Okay, it's this part of their agenda. But while they're doing that, let's look at source number four, which is a rather remarkable text. And I have to say, for some people, find this text rather disturbing. So brace yourself. The Gemara here suggests that Ezra did not only promote the writing of Sifrei Torah, but he actually changed the Sefer Torah itself. Okay, if you look on the sort of funny letters that are on the bottom left-hand side of the sheet, okay, we have here on the left-hand side what we call Ktav Ivri, ancient Jewish font. On the right-hand side, the ones you can probably read, I assume many of you can, okay, is what we call Ktav Ashuri. Now, as you can even hear, Ktav Ashuri, what's Ashur?
Assyria.
Assyria. Okay, doesn't sound very Jewish to me. Ktav Ivri sounds more Jewish than Assyrian. Okay, however, apparently this is what we call the Assyrian font. Okay, if you want to read up more about this, I don't know, you can look in any Jewish encyclopedia, look in the Encyclopedia Judaica, open to the entry alphabet, And they will show you how ancient Hebrew script is very related to many other Semitic cultures, but it doesn't look anything like what's on the right. What's on the right is a font which we brought back somehow from Assyria. Look at what the Gemara says here. Gemara from Sanhedrin. Amamar Zutra v'itemamar ukva bitchila, in the beginning, nitna Torah li'Israel biktav ivri v'lashon ha'kodesh. When the Torah was given to Am Yisrael, the Torah was given in Ktav Ivri, the one you can't read, okay? And Lashon HaKodesh. It was Hebrew and written in that font. So therefore, if you see the movie The Ten Commandments, right? You know, they did it like that. That's how they knew. They loved the Gemara in Sanhedrin, okay? Chazra v'nitna lahem, listen to this phrase. Chazra v'nitna lahem b'mei Ezra. In the days of Ezra, it was re-given b'ktav Ashuri v'lashon Arami. It was given in Aramaic and also in the right-hand font. Okay? Now listen to the strange phrasing here. Biruru lahem Yisrael ktav ashurit b'lashon ha'kodesh. In other words, Ezra, it sounds like, was prepared. Ezra, by the way, Ezra is called Ezra ha-sofer. Okay? Now the word sofer probably doesn't mean he was a scribe. It probably means he was a Talmid Chacham, like we say in our Shemona Yisrei, pleitat sofrehem. Sofer there doesn't mean scribe, but it means rather, sort of scholar. But we see him as very intimately related to the writing of the Tanakh. And therefore, it says, Ezra was prepared to bring the Torah and write it, even in translation in Aramaic, with the Assyrian font. Why would he do this? Because when people came back from Babel, number one, they didn't understand it. They spoke more Aramaic than Hebrew. Okay, and number two, they couldn't read it. Right? They used a different alphabet. So he was prepared to change it. Biru lahem Yisrael, but Israel, Am Yisrael, didn't want to let go of the Hebrew. So Biru lahem Yisrael, ktav ashurit, they chose the new font, v'lashon ha'kodesh. It's amazing how pliable it seems things were, right? V'hinichu lehedyotot ktav ivrit, and they left to the hedyotot, the plain people, what's called ktav ivrit, the left-hand font. V'lashon arami, man hedyotot, hu hedyotot, amar Rav Chisda kutai. Right, kutai means what we nowadays call the Samaritans. Okay, kutim. In other words, apparently the Samaritans kept the old font, which indeed I think their holy books are written in that font, Samaritan scrolls. But they wrote things in Aramaic. However, we kept Hebrew, but with the new font. So this is quite remarkable. By the way, the Gemara continues and says, Tanya Rabbi Yossi Omer Ra'ui Haya Ezra Shetinaten Torah Al Yado Yisrael. Ezra could have given the Torah, you know, he is so great, he himself could have given the Torah. In other words, I'll put it slightly differently. Ezra is like, in a sense, a second Matan Torah. He's a second Moshe. And he has the power to be able to actually adjust the font of the Torah. In other words, if we nowadays would find Moshe Rabbeinu Sefer Torah, it would have, more or less, all the same words, okay? But we wouldn't be able to read it because it would be in a different font. Again, I'm stressing, it's the same words. It's just like, you know, when you put your mouse over things, you change it from Times New Roman to Arial to whatever it is, okay? So that's what he did. He just changed the font. They're the same letters, but they're just different letters.
So when you see the Zohar Torah, so much that's a bit of a flip.
You have to talk about it creatively when we say the Zohar Torah. Like, we don't even think that really was the Torah. In all essence, it is the Torah, but you are correct, right? In other words, yes. It's not exactly the Torah, but to all intents and purposes it is. Okay. By the way, if we're talking about the text itself, right, we should mention another thing, okay, which is source number 5. Again, I'm really not trying to get involved in questions of biblical criticism and what have you, but I'm trying to put this out there in terms of just to understand what a radical revolutionary, right, Ezra was. You know, in certain places in the Torah, there are dots. On Vayishakehu, for example, when Yaakov meets Esav, there are dots. On Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu in Parshat Nitzavim, I think, Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu v'anigot lanu levenu ad olam, you go look in the Torah, there are dots. Now, anybody here who's probably done any manuscript work with any manuscripts of Talmud or what have you, you will know that in manuscript notation, if you put dots over something, it usually means that you're going to erase that letter. Nowadays, we sort of erase or put white out, but then they didn't. So they put dots on, it meant it's going to be erased. The question is why we have dots in the Torah. So sometimes, by the way, they understand in terms of parashanut. This is the view I'm going to give is not the only view. There are, for example, like the familiar one is by Vayishakehu, when Yaakov and Esav meet and they embrace. So it says Vayishakehu, he kissed him. That Lona Shakob b'chol libo, Rashi brings one opinion. He didn't kiss him wholeheartedly. If you want the other opinion, he tried to bite him, but I won't. That's more difficult with the words, because it says he kissed him. Okay, fine. But listen to this. Midrash comes from Avot Rabbi Natan. It's mentioned in other Midrashim too. Esther Nekudot Elohim. Why do we have these 10 Nekudot, these 10 dots? Lama Elakach Amar Ezra. Ezra said, Im Yavo Eliyahu V'yomar Li Mibnei Makataf Tekach. If Eliyahu Anavi comes to me and say, why did you write these words? Omer Anilo, I'll say to him, Kfar Nekadati Alehem. I already designated them to be erased. V'im Omar Lo Li. And if he says to me, Yafek Atafta, Ishkoyach, well done. I'm glad you put that in. Right? Avir nekuda me'alehem, I'll take away the dots. What this is telling me is that Ezra really tried to work on the text of the Torah, but there are some places he wasn't sure. You might be aware, one of the opinions, there are many opinions on why we have kri and ketiv. Sometimes we have a different word that we read than we write. There are two versions. According to one opinion, the Amar Rabbanu hated this opinion, he went ballistic at this opinion, but I think it's the opinion of the Radak, if I'm not mistaken, says that Kri and Ketiv is Ezra wasn't sure of the words. There are some places where Ezra wasn't sure of the spelling, so he put both. One we read, and one we write. And then you've got two alternative versions. What this is telling me is two things. Number one, there were doubts about the Torah and exactly the correct text. Number two, Ezra worked as hard as he could to try and perfect the text. And when he had a doubt, he found a way to express that doubt. But Ezra was about trying to... Now, by the way, this is not a huge surprise. A nation goes into galut, goes and dispersed in different countries. You have a text that's being copied out by hand. Okay, all you need is a few tired scribes. And suddenly you develop, however hard they try, alternative versions. If any of you... I've just gone through the process of writing a book, right? It's amazing how many mistakes. This book has been proofread and this and that and the other. And there are mistakes in it. And I can't even tell you how much work went into doing that. So, Kol B'chol, the Torah, however good you are, we're only human. Okay? So, mistakes come in. Ezra is one of his... We come back from Galut. So, imagine. Jews came back from Egypt. They bring Sefer Torah. It's a bit different from the Sefer Torah that came back from Persia. This isn't a matter of faith, by the way. It's just like... It's obvious. I mean, it would be almost remarkable if it wasn't that way. Right? And therefore, Ezra is working to make sure the text of the Torah is robust, and to come up with a single text. Okay? So that tells us what Ezra did. I'm going to go through... Yes? The question is... No, I think there was a text in his time of the Torah. Okay? However, my assumption is, let's say he had his authoritative Torah, but somebody else comes along with another Torah and says, this is the authoritative Torah from Alexandria. Then what do? Right? In fact, there's a famous writer which talks about three authoritative straight Torah where they had to adjust each one according to the other. So they're trying to use parallel texts in order to ensure that the text is correct. Okay? All right. I want to relate maybe to two more things and then try and sort of summarize this. Let's take a look at text number 6. Talking about Ha'emidu Talmidim Harbe. The Gemara says, Asara Takanot Tikein Ezra. Ezra established 10 Takanot. Right? That's apart from what we've seen. Shekorim B'mincha B'Shabbat. You're meant to read Torah and Shabbos Mincha. Okay? Korim B'Sheni V'Chamishi. You're meant to read Torah on Mondays and Thursdays. Danim B'Sheni Chamishi. Courts sit on Monday and Thursdays. U'mechabsim B'Chamishi B'Shabbat. Washing day is on Thursdays. Interesting. V'ochlim shum be'erev Shabbat. You're meant to eat garlic on Erev Shabbat. Okay. V'shetei isha mashkemet rofa. Fine. Let's go through just a few examples of this. Okay. The Gemara says, Shukorim b'mincha b'shabbat, that they read mincha b'shabbat. Why? Mishum yoshvei kronot. Right? Yoshvei kronot means people who sit on street corners. I'll put it in my language. When are people free? They've already eaten lunch. They've already gone to sleep. Ah, then there's mincha. Now people can listen. So you should read Shabbat mincha. Why? Because that's when people have time to sit and hear a shir. Okay, this is a Shabbos afternoon shir. Shabbos mincha shir. The Gemara then continues and says, Shukorim b'shabbat sheni b'chamishi, Ezra tikein v'hame kara habitakna. Did Ezra really establish that we should read Torah on Mondays and Thursdays? That was already an old takana, and they go through how that is. Maybe I'll just read a few lines here. Doesn't it say in the Torah, Ve'alchu shloshet yamim b'midbar v'lo matzu mayim, they walked 3 days in the wilderness, they didn't find water. Doroshei reshumot amru, they derived from this, Ein mayim ela Torah. That what they couldn't exist with was not water, but the real water is Torah. And therefore, you, just like you can't exist without water for 3 days, you can't exist without Torah. In other words, even when they were in the wilderness, they read Torah every 3 days. Right? So that would be, you read on Shabbos, then 7 day weeks, so you need to read, you know, to have not 3 days, but you have to read Monday and Thursday. So they say, so what did Ezra do? Right? Well, I'll just quickly read the Gemara. Kevan shohu shloshet yamim b'lo Torah nil'u, when they went 3 days without Torah, they faded. Amdu neviim shebineihem, the neviims, v'tiknu lehem shu korim b'shabbat u'masikim b'echad b'shabbat, v'korim b'sheini u'masikim shlishi revi'i, v'korim b'chamishi u'masikim erev shabbat, k'dei sheloin linu shloshet yamim b'lo Torah. So, you know what, this is a long Gemara, let me maybe just summarize it for you. They come out with an understanding that no, Ezra didn't invent reading on Mondays and Thursdays. So what did he invent? Okay, so they say he did a few things. Number one, he decided that Torah should be translated. They should have a Maturgaman. Number two, you always have to, Ezra decided instead of reading just 3 psukim, you have to read 10 psukim. Why 10? We'll talk about it, okay? Not only do you have to read 10 psukim, but you need to call up a Kohen and a Levi and a Yisrael. And the question is, why all these laws? Why do you need to read at Shabbos Mincha? You have to have a translator, you have to read 10 psukim. There's a very beautiful article about, by Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik talks about the institution of Moshe to read Torah and the institution of Ezra. And he says, I'll put it very simply this way. The original takana of Torah was this. Read every 3 days. Why? Because just like you can't do without water, you can't do without Torah. What was that? Only two, and by the way, that meant only reading 3 verses. 3 verses? You can't understand anything of 3 verses. So Rav Soloveitchik said, exactly. When we read the Torah, we just read 3 verses originally, Shabbat, Monday and Thursday, we were like sort of saying, Torah, this is what we believe in. It was like sort of like a pledge of allegiance, right? Or it was like a sort of a statement of principles, where I turn around and says, the Torah is our fuel. Did you understand that Torah? No, you only read 3 verses. Ezra came along and said, I want Torah to be an experience where people will learn. Let's translate it. Let's read 10 verses, right? So that it's a bit you can sort of get your hands on. Let's read it at a time when people are free to think about it. Shabbat afternoon. Let's call up a Kohen and a Levi and Israel to show that Torah doesn't just belong to the priests, but it belongs to the people. Rav Soloveitchik said that when originally Torah was instituted, it was sort of like that everybody could look at it and say, hey, that's what we believe in. It was a pledge of allegiance. Ezra turned Kriyasa Torah into Talmud Torah. Ezra turned it from a, you know, if you want a statutory experience, into a learning experience. And that's what he tried to do. But again, what did he do? He prescribed the contours of Kriyat Torah. By the way, the last thing the Rambam mentions that Ezra did was he created Kriyat Torah in a timely manner. That it should match the yearly schedule. Okay? So that we should read topical things on topical moments. In other words, he wanted Torah to be relevant. So, oh, by the way, the idea of, for example, clothing being laundered on Thursday, right, which you mentioned, it's a very strange thing, was very simple. You had to spend a whole day, you know, cleaning clothes, and then you had to hang them out to dry the next day. That means that everybody had clean clothes for Shabbat. That's what it was about. Okay. All right. So what we have here is a whole set of things that Ezra creates, which I would argue are shaping a whole, if you want, a different Judaism. Ezra has, if you want, changed the entire text of the Sefer Torah. Okay? He has created a whole new way of reading Sefer Torah so that it becomes a studious experience. He has created a whole liturgy, which has enabled us to create shuls. If you want, so we've also mentioned Muktzah. So there's a huge expansion of the laws of Shabbat. Okay? And other things, if you want, because I'll talk about Shniot L'Arayot and other things to do with family life. A whole series of changes. What do we do with this, right? So I want to argue that these changes, first of all, in a sense, it's a big surprise. We frequently talk about a sort of a chain of tradition, and we talk about sort of maybe we like to feel that halacha sort of evolves in very delicate increments. But here we see where there's a huge big step in the road, okay? And Ezra, again, he was living in remarkable times. We had gone into exile, we had come back, okay? And when we came back, I'll try and put it in non-delicate terms. Judaism was a bit of a train wreck after this, okay? Ezra comes back, nobody's paying attention to the temple, nobody's supporting the priests, people aren't keeping Shabbat, people are marrying out. There was a real question about the continuity of Judaism. And Ezra decides he's going to do everything in his power, and he had a lot in his power, to really expand this whole situation and create an environment in which Torah would be more understandable, translate Torah, put it in a font that people can read, okay? Create all sorts of new liturgy to help people to feel God is in their lives all the time. Now, of course, the question is, I've had people turn around to me at this point and say, yeah, but this is reform, right? So I don't know if it's reform with a capital R. I know it's a reform, okay? He reformed a lot of things. It was certainly a halachic revolution. But in order to understand and appreciate this halachic revolution, I want us to turn to the last page here and look at a passage which is a really beautiful passage from Rav Kook. The passage from Rav Kook, you've got it on one side in Hebrew, in the other side in English. Rav Kook's Hebrew is beautiful, but it's very dense and difficult to read. But we will try maybe and look at a few lines of it. let me just say that what Rav Kook is talking about here is a passage in the Gemara where it talks about Chacham Adif Minavi. Okay? The sage is greater than the prophet. I would imagine that some of you have come across this phrase either in the Gemara in Baba Batra or maybe in its version where the Rambam talks about it. Chacham Adif Minavi. The Rambam talks about when he says, if any of you remember the passage in Introduction to the Mishnah, he says, let's say we're arguing about something in the Beis HaMedrash, okay, and, you know, one person says this, there's a machlokas, I don't know, you know, Mishnah Berurah says one thing, the Aruch HaShulchan says something else, who do we follow? In bursts a Navi, Eliyahu HaNavi, and says, Mishnah Berurah is correct. So we say to him, thank you very much, Eliyahu HaNavi, please stay here, bring the Mashiach, but Chacham Adif Minavi, sort of like Lola Shamayim, okay? We value scholarship more than we value prophecy, Chacham Adif Minavi. That is how Maimonides understands this principle. But Rav Kook is going to take it in a very, very different direction, and let me try and explain what he's going to do. To even get into Rav Kook, I'm going to introduce an idea which again is going to sound a little bit radical. Rav Kook is going to claim, let's say this, Nevuah, the notion of prophecy, it was an incredible tool from the beginning of the Torah through the whole Bayit Rishon period. And at the beginning of Bayit Sheni, we have three Nevi'im, Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi. But Chazal tell us that basically in Bayit Sheni there was no Nevuah, there was no prophecy. Where did it go? Why did it disappear? God doesn't want to talk to man. What? Where did the ball go? Rav Kook is going to claim. And there are a lot of ways of understanding this. And you could have a whole shiur in its own right. But Rav Kook is essentially going to claim that at some level, prophecy as a system failed. Why did prophecy fail? Or how did prophecy fail? Well, I'll ask very simply. What do the prophets in the Beit Rishon all the time tell us not to do? Don't do idolatry, okay? And if you do idolatry, what's going to happen? Temple's going to be destroyed and you're going to go into exile. Okay? Okay. So, what happened? The temple was destroyed and we went into exile, right? So, didn't work, right? I mean, in other words, prophet after prophet, the greatest people, we still, you know, by the way, these prophets weren't very good in their own time, but they've been much better since, you know, afterwards. I mean, we still read Yeshayahu, we get inspired, we read Amos and we're inspired, right? Unfortunately, at the time, the people didn't listen to them. Now we listen to them. But essentially, in Beit Rishon, the prophets are pushing, again, I don't mean to be irreverent, but they're pushing for change, and there are few, really few cases in which the people ever listen to the Navi. Right? They throw them in jail. They beat them up. You know, read Yirmiyahu, it's unbelievable. Okay, so the question is, what exactly is the role of prophecy, and what superseded prophecy? So, let's just take a look a little bit about how Rav Kook talks, and then I'll try and we'll read the first paragraph, and then, well, first paragraph and a bit, but and then I'll try and explain what he says. B'noheg sheba'olam ha'mashorerim v'amalitzim etarim yafeh. You're welcome to read along in English. The way of the world is that poets and artists describe beautifully the beauty of life, all of its magnificent corners in particular, which include the flow of life, the dew of life, and they know also, the artists and the poets, how to display the general filth and all of the degenerate sides of life and to protest against them with full force. Okay? That's how Rav Kook begins. Let's try and explain. Even today, right, you have various artists in the music world and various, you know, poets and journalists who will turn around and they'll take up, I don't know what it will be, it will be global warming, it will be the plight of this population or that population, this political cause or that political cause, and say, there is a lack of justice in the world. Okay? And that's what they say. Or, at other times, they will display things in beautiful ways. This is true in our own day. It's true, you know, I don't know, go back a century or two, you know, you want to go with Wordsworth, you know, wandering, you know, amongst the daffodils, or, you know, you can read Charles Dickens about, you know, Victorian England, one displaying the beauty, one displaying how ugly society can be. That's what they do, okay? But he says, you know what, maybe I will read in English because I see we're not going to have time. But he says, but the passionate force of the imaginative faculty is unable to determine the various factors and particular conditions that preserve life and safeguard it from defects that are liable to generate very destructive consequences. This is a body of knowledge that concerns itself with particulars. Here begins the work of physicians, economists, engineers, judges, and all those who pursue practical fields. Let me explain. I'll put it very simply. You can decide that you want to solve the problem of global warming. But now, you can scream and shout, you can create a big concert about it, you can raise lots of money, but are you going to change anything? No. You have to understand how politics work, you have to get the politicians to sign the Kyoto Agreement or whatever it is, to curb carbon emissions and to do other things, and then to follow through. So here you need lobbyists and politicians and, you know, legal experts and some sort of enforcement method, right? I don't know, I grew up in the 80s, you know, Band-Aid, you know, Food for Africa, Live Aid, whatever it was. Bob Geldof decided he was going to save Africa, okay? However, the history tells us that most of the $130 million that he raised through his worldwide concert didn't get to Africa. Why? Because there were militias there, because the government stole half the food, because things got lost in administrative costs. In other words, you don't have the best idea of wanting to save the world, but you've got to worry about the nitty-gritty and deal with that. So the artist can give you all the beauty. They can show you all the filth, but then you need to go, as he says, you need those physicians, economists, engineers, judges, practical tools. Okay. This distinction has even wider application. Prophecy saw the evil of idolatry in ancient Israel and protested against it with all might. It envisioned the majesty and delight associated with belief in one God. In other words, there you have the bad and the good. Prophecy could describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeshayahu sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shulav Mleim Et Haichal Kadosh Kadosh Kadosh, at the same time, right, protests against the degenerate nature of society. Okay? Portrayed it in all its radiance. He saw corruption and moral depravity, and it was religiously inspired to change society through its holy and sophisticated articulation. But the little lapses out of which was forged the gross body of sin, these remained hidden from the eye of every prophet and seer. It is only the practical daily observance of mitzvot with all their detailed laws that will decisively vanquish the darkness of idolatry. Through the observance, study, habituated performance, and love of the law, after a span of time, they will release the hidden elegance and grace along with the pulse of pure godly living. What's he saying? He's saying something very simple. We all like the big ideas, okay, but what really changes us? It is the things which we do in our everyday Judaism. In the Hebrew, he talks about a rope. And he says, what's a rope made out of? Lots of smaller fibers. In fact, a rope will particularly find lots of little ropes. And those ropes are made out of little fibers, right? The other example he gives is an artery. And an artery, the blood comes from very small capillaries, you know, and then they, larger blood vessels and larger blood vessels until the blood flows through the veins and back and forth, okay? So that's how things work. In other words, he says we have to go from the fine grade to the large grade. What does that mean? Sometimes we think about, we learn the Mishnah Berurah, put this shoe on right first, and that shoe on, or we worry about every sif katan, every little bit of the Shulchan Aruch of the Mishnah Berurah, and we think, you know, what's that going to change my life? Rav Kook claims that involvement in the minutiae of life actually had a more fundamental, more penetrating change to people's lifestyle than all of the great speeches of the prophets. Because what did they? They got into our lives, into every little bit. Every time you put something in your mouth, you say a bracha. You've got to daven it 3 times a day, and you've got to say it this way and that way. And if you didn't say Masha Baruch, you go back to the beginning, right? And somehow all of those laws became, in a deeper way than any prophet could change society. They created our Judaism. He says, all right. If you look on the second column, because I realize our time is coming to an end, it was therefore necessary to assign the expression of broad principle to the prophets and particulars to the sages. As the Talmud declares, the sage is more important than the prophet. He's saying, what Chazal came along with, the Takanot of Chazal, the different creations of the Anshei Knesset Hagdolah, were greater than what prophecy did. Why? Because they found a way into our lives which was more long-lasting than all of the, and more effectual than the prophets. And what prophecy with its impassioned and fiery exhortations could not accomplish in purging the Jewish people of idolatry and in uprooting the basic causes of the most degrading forms of oppression and violence, murder, sexual perversity and bribery, was accomplished by the sages through the expanded development of Torah, by raising many disciples, Emidu Talmidim Harber, that's what he says, and by the assiduous study of the particular laws and their derivative applications. The eternal paths lead to him. The term paths, halichot, altikra halichot, ela halachot. Okay? The laws lead to him. I think that's a very interesting analysis. You might say, well, prophecy obviously is direct line to God. Okay? But no, somehow Ezra's genius, in this huge expansion, this huge review of Jewish law, was actually to put us in a situation whereby the Judaism we have today is actually in some way thankful to Ezra. We went into Gullah for 50 years and the whole thing almost fell apart. We've been in Gullah 2,000 years and the structures still stand. Okay? Might have a few cracks here and there. Okay? But the structure's still standing. Okay? Wow. And to a certain degree, Rav Kook is suggesting, and I think we're suggesting here, those things which were put into place by Ezra are still here today. And that is a given, and admittedly, as you said, to do with the text of the Torah, right? Maybe Vezot HaTorah Shel Moshe, okay, he adjusted the font, but it's the same Torah, right? The other danger would be that the Torah would become obsolete and there would be no Torah, okay? So this is the what we're doing. Now, what's important, by the way, is also to read the last bit of Rav Kook. So now he comes down to, I think, a very important point. In the course of time, the concern with the work of sages predominated over the work of the prophets. And the institution of prophecy ceased altogether. After some time, the general principles declined. They were imminent in the particulars, but were not readily apparent. What's he saying? He's saying social justice existed, but it was enveloped in the laws. Okay? Nobody spoke about social justice like the prophets did, but they're enveloped in the laws. Nobody spoke about the beauty of God. They were invested into the laws of tefillah. But he says, at the end of the present epoch, when the light of prophecy will begin to have its revival, as we're promised, I shall pour out my spirit on all flesh, there will develop a reaction, a pronounced disdain for the particulars. He says, we're going to get to a time when people are going to say, enough halacha, enough Mishnah Brura, enough detail this, we're overburdened with this. By the way, I'm sure Rav Kook was fully aware of this. Not only did he have a very close relationship with many of the early Zionists who had thrown off the shackles of the shtetl, but he grew up in Volozhin, right? And in Volozhin there was a huge Haskalah underground in the yeshiva, and he was very aware of the currents of Eastern Jewry. And if you read the writings of Haskalah, if you read the writings of early Zionism, a lot of the early Zionists say, it's not a question of anti-Semitism like Herzl says, it's a question that we feel that Judaism is too small-minded. Judaism is worried about all these minutiae. And what's it going to do with life? We want a country, and we want an army, and we want an agriculture. They were looking to revive. I think it was a Haram who said, the problem is not the Jewish people, the problem is Judaism. We need a new Judaism. Rav Kook is aware of these things. He says, people will develop a pronounced disdain for the particulars. This is alluded in the Talmudic statement that at the dawn of the Messianic age, the wisdom of the sages will become unsavory. And those who live in the boundary, the sages who define limits in law, will turn from city to city without finding grace. This will continue until the radiance of prophecy will re-emerge from its hiding and reveal itself, not as unripe fruit, but as the full fruits of vitality of life. And prophecy itself will acknowledge the great achievements and effectiveness of the sages, and in righteous humility exclaim, the sage is more important than the prophet. What is he saying? He's saying, we need a rebound. Says Rav Kook, we need a rebound. Halacha's done its stuff. Halacha's changed the Jewish world. It's created a very serious Judaism. But never forget the big picture. Big picture he describes as spirituality on the one side, the world of spirituality, appreciating God. And on the other side, appreciating how there can be moral outrage, and we have to be outraged by it. Sometimes when we're involved in all of the small halacha, we don't notice this. He says we have to have the big picture. It's got to re-emerge. Now, the interesting thing is, Rav Kook, by the way, is a very evolutionary thinker. So he feels that in the time of Mashiach, there will be not one or the other, but rather the two will merge, they'll fuse. He says, even prophecy will say, Chacham Adif Min Avi. Prophecy will say, I appreciate how great halacha is, but we have to have both. Okay? And that's how he finishes, where he says, this transcending of one-sidedness will vindicate the vision of unity expressed by the psalmist. Mercy and truth have met, justice and peace have kissed. Truth, which is the law, will rise out from the earth, and mercy will show itself from heaven. In other words, what do we want? If you look at the sukkim themselves, the passage that he's quoting is Chesed ve'emetz nafgashu, Tzedek v'shalom nashaku, Emet meretz itzmach, the truth, which he thinks is Chazal, will come from below, that's rabbinic writing, v'tzedek mishamayim neshka, and righteousness will come from the heavens, and Gam Hashem titein tov v'artzenu titein nivula. What I've tried to do is give you, in this short shir, what I've tried to do is give an impression of what I think is an amazing period in the development of Jewish law. As I said, we know very little about this period, but everything that we're told throughout the Gemara, again, by the way, I hope you'll notice, I didn't bring any academic sources here, right? This is all from the Gemara, right? If I said anything radical, they said it. It is quite radical in the fact that Ezra engaged this in a very, very strong review of Jewish law. I would argue it really saved Judaism. It took us from the era of Nevuah to a new era of, let's call it Halakha, development of, or maybe we'll call it, Torah Shebaal Peh, where Torah Shebaal Peh took the prime, if you want, academic language of the rabbinic period, right? And suddenly we went into this new different mode. Rav Kook says they each have their own strengths. One has this amazing, you know, poetic side to it, right? The ability to be disgusted at the bad things in society, to be excited about spirituality. That didn't seem to be affecting things on a ground level. Along comes Halacha and tries to really regulate our life. However, we must never forget that we have to be swinging this pendulum backwards and forwards. And he says there'll be a period of Jewish history after thousands of years development of Torah Shebaal Peh where we're going to need to see the big picture. I personally think a lot of that's happening nowadays. People are awakening to new sides of spirituality. People are looking for Judaism to have a strong and clear moral voice on moral questions and ethical issues within society. And maybe it's our responsibility to take a commitment to, a serious commitment to Halakha, which, as Rav Kook, I think, argues quite well, is one of the more powerful sides of Judaism and really does affect our lives, and graft it to a very, very strong moral voice. And that way we will hopefully be able to create this wonderful hybrid, which is how Judaism is meant to be. So thank you very much. And if anybody wants to ask any questions or...
Your Ur source from Avot tries to establish a chain where Torah Shebaal Peh comes from Sinai. You are saying that invention of Ezra, so it seems to contradict your very source.
Okay, that's a good point. Okay, you're saying is that Pirkei Avot establishes this as being a chain of tradition where I argued there's a sort of much more of a revolution and takana. It could be the both the truth, right? In other words, that there is a chain of Masorah, and of course Ezra knew about Halachot which were passed to him. And the nature of something which we call a takana is always something brand new. Okay, that is true. It's a very good question. Maybe if I wanted to be more polemicist, I could argue that maybe Dafka Pirkei Avot is trying to establish Ezra because he is such a revolutionary as part of a chain, but I think I'd have to do some more study of that Mishnah in order to say that with any verification. I don't know. I do think that one of the difficulties in a lot of our shuls is Kriyat HaTorah. That's why so much talking goes on during Kriyat HaTorah. And, you know, I don't know whether we need a Matur Gaman or I don't know what we need, right? Shuls try all different methods. You know, the Rav will give somebody to give an explanation between each Aliyah, right? I mean, my personal preference is people should study the Parsha very well and they'll find Parshat Shavua very exciting. Okay, but definitely you see how, first of all, there's a real attempt to make Kriyat HaTorah relevant. And that's a big challenge for us in our shuls and in our lives, right? How to really connect with the text of Torah, how to make it a cogent force in our religious lives, something relevant and not just a sort of ritual act that is, you know, sort of like, you know, tolerated. So maybe that's something we have to actively work at. Yes? Well, I think this is a classic tension between keeping tradition and not making too much of a break. In this regard, it's actually Ezra's the radical, and the people are going, hey, you know, take it easy, man. You know, that's too radical for us. You want that continuity with the past, right? But you've also have got to achieve relevance, okay? And this is things we're struggling with our current, you know, anybody who's got their ears to the blogosphere, right, knows these are things we're struggling with at the moment. How to keep things relevant, but still remain as true to tradition. And of course, different people are pulling on either side of that line. Yes?
Yeah. song, so to speak, but the content of meaning. Okay. This actually, I heard from Rabbi Huttner the one time my life I went to hear him. I don't know if it's in Mahavitra, but that's the thought that he suggested.
Okay, I know it's not easy to come after a day at work to a shiur in the evening, so I just really want to say a big yishkoach to you to come out on a cold evening and coming to learn Torah. So thank you very much. And if anybody wants a book, I have them here for sale. Yeah. Yes, thank you. She's wonderful, amazing speaker.
It puts that things in perspective. We'll be shocked by the time it's going on.
Without Avodah Zarah, you also don't need Moshe. Somehow protected. It's only about direct news.
24 is the number of books and games, right? So it's the number of fasts. It's the whole thing with the Sefer.
How are you doing?
Thank you.
So good to see you.
Same to you. You don't have to remember me. You have like a million students in 10 years. But
Tamir.
Dana.
Dana, sorry.
It's
okay.
Orod.
Back
in the day,
okay,
10 years
fine.
Ago. So
okay.
We're good.
Okay.
Important things I remember what you said. So that's good. How are you?
You've got a bad back. You're so stretching and whatever it is. I'm Baruch Hashem, I'm very well.
Yeah?
Really very well. Yeah.
The little crazy Mayan is now grown up, right?
Oh, yeah. She's very grown up.
I just remember stories.
15 years old.
Whoa.
And,
okay.
Yeah. Still crazy though.
Well, I don't want to take too much of your time. Thank
it's
you.
Fine.
And I hope to see
thank you for coming.
I
see all of these faces here. Of,
I'll see you in Israel.
Okay. The very good. Hello, how are you? This is so amazing. I don't know about a second. I'd say you've been waiting. Hello, how are you? Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you. I was just wondering if there are any sources internally about why the language, why the script was changed.
I think the assumption is that people, you know, couldn't understand the ancient Hebrew script. And
so,
they came from sort of Assyria, and it was the, you know, it was what they used there.
Okay, so Assyrian was the language spoken in the
in Persia or whatever it was. Yeah.
Thank you.
How are you?
Yeah.
I've done so much. I can't believe that's my answer.
Your speech. I went to a Jewish history museum and I saw a very, very old copy of the Zarathustra book written in I think this is Kitab HaShuri, right?
No, Shuri is this one. This is Tavivu, ancient Hebrew script.
Okay, so...
I don't know where they would have any evidence of the Aser HaDibrot written for this. But the assumption is the Aser HaDibrot would have been written in this sort of script.
Yeah, they had it in this one.
Right.
So, one thing that's hard to understand is I always thought the halachot of writing a sefer Torah is you have to be so careful with the letter, it has to be the exact letter.
Well, once you decide that those are sort of the Masoretic letters, halacha defines it as that, so we have to be careful. But there is an opinion which said that originally those were the letters, and they got changed, and then they got changed back. But I find that difficult to understand. But Al-Pi Kabbalah, according to the Kabbalah, they have a lot of interpretation of these letters. So how you understand that with this Gemara is difficult
to
understand.
There's so many different Torah, like looking at the letter Aleph and how it touches right. Ben Hashemayim and Ha'aretz, that they like transformed and everything, and then you, like, I don't know.
Right, so then you'd have to somehow say